new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both. Farah Hughes, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SAS soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice. The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. As you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down. People who were unarmed, including
why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered, and then, you know, perhaps again, with, as you said, no prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda, and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January. Right. 1972, and the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces. A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the, first the general, overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed, and then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed, because that needs to be unfortunately or fortunately reviewed here so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SAS soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. There is discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country. It's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous. And so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or is being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But Fra Hughes, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where it is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m., you have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home, a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old who were staying there overnight were taken, and a witness said, "When I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere." Is that what SAS soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically these special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information, and they're trained to terrorize the local population. You don't have to go any further than, was it Abu Ghraib, when you see what happened in the prison with the torture, with prisoners that were naked, that were attacked by dogs. The dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of like Western imperialism. So, the brutality, there'll be nobody held to account. And these people will just basically get away with murder, and the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascists there, it's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held the account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Frentina, and you said that this may be, or that this is, how orders have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation of 100 years. And throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look at what the British did in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians, and have been for decades now, violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane. And these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes. But countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Fra Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. When you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and they're basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually brought into, or is bringing onto the statute books, a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge, and Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British armed forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Fentanyl, where it's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defence that created what was called the and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now, between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with the stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims receive no closure, there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability, and this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for our Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the ruling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for the for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when we take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had U.S. soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they've used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son, it's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable, and in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR, it's all propaganda, it's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And, you know, from the day in our, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, people will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where, Robert Fintina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court at The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. So when this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are, they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
It's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched or is in early next year will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings may be determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back, as our guest there was talking, Frahuz, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former U.S. President George Bush Jr., who have walked scot-free and they've been responsible for so many deaths And still, the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used, that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, in my mind, is a war criminal, and so is Bush. And all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there's still landmines. There are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, you know, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the Chilcot report, and it made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumours that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Sure. Looking down the road here, Robert Fantino, quickly, if you can answer this, are we looking at pretty much the status quo to continue? Based on the fact that you're not getting the prosecutions that these cases deserve for any future endeavors in a war scenario that in particular the U.S. may be involved with or the U.K., because usually they're, you know, work with this special relationship they have hand in hand.
Yes, and most of the wars on the planet do involve the United States in one way or another. And yes, sadly, we are going to see a maintenance of the status quo. There will be some, as I mentioned before, some minor findings from this current investigation, as there were from U.S. investigations about abuses in Iraq. But then the next war will see the same kinds of crimes, same kinds of cover-ups, and the same kinds of pseudo-investigations. When you have the British government investigating its own soldiers, or the U.S. government investigating its own soldiers, that is not an impartial judge. There needs to be these things need to go to the ICC so that they can be viewed impartially. Otherwise, we're going to see the same continually.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantino, author and journalist. Fra Hughes, thank you so much, journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Yacoba Tahoe and the team. It's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, family pathology and emotional trauma. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of family pathology and emotional trauma in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that when we talk about the family pathology, we need to look at different reasons and effects that causes the pathology in the family, that causes the weakness of the family. And the first thing that we can talk about is the emotional trauma that we see generally in the families. And this causes not to have a proper or a good Islamic lifestyle. Why? Because in Islamic lifestyle, when Islam is giving importance to the family, the formation of the family, the relationship within the family, then obviously we should avoid some things that hurts this relationship. So the emotional trauma, if we can give some examples about that, is that, for example, when kids, they do not care about their parents, and when they make their parents angry, especially in the Western society, what we see is that kids want to become independent, they don't want to follow the instructions of their parents, and therefore we see that this family system is destroyed in the West. The way we see in the East, how the parents, how the kids, how the brothers and sisters are living together in one house, taking care of each other. But unfortunately, the Western or secular system tells us not to have this family relation. Even when the parents become old, we try to send them to the old age houses, which is not a good thing according to the Islamic teaching. So we need to be very much careful when we are dealing with our parents so that we can have a true Islamic lifestyle by respecting our parents, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of family pathology and the emotional trauma. And we said that this emotional trauma, for example, the first example is like when the kids or the children, they are making their parents unhappy or they're teasing them sometimes, which is resulted in the destruction of the family, the system of family. And this is something which is forbidden in Islam. The second thing is that when we blame the pure woman to have the wrong, we can say like relations with others, which is wrong, we blame them. We where they are the pure women. And obviously in the Quran as well, in the Quran, when we look at the chapter Nur, when we look at chapter Nur, and verse number 23, in that also, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has stopped us from talking about the pure ladies, pure women, and to not to associate wrong things with them. Obviously, there Allah says like, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, la tattabi'u khutuwati shayati. Do not follow the footsteps of shaytan. And why? Because shaitan orders you bil-fahsha, the immorality, wal-murkar, and the evil. And where Allah talks about the rahmah and the fadl. And therefore, we need to be careful about this. And Allah says, inna alladhina yarmuna, and those who accuse al-muhsanat, the chaste woman, the pure woman, al-ghafilat, the unaware woman, al-mu'minat, the believing woman, lu'inu fi dunya wal-akhirah. Those who basically talk about the pure women, the women who have the chastity, and they tell them that they are unaware, they are the doers of bad actions, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لُعِنُوا فِي الدُّنْيَا, Allah cursed them in this world and in hereafter, and there is azab for them. Yes, there are sometimes people become angry, sometimes we close our eyes, sometimes we do not know the fact. It does not mean to blame someone. It does not mean to especially blame the women of the house. Maybe it is from other women. Maybe it is from the gents, husband, father, brother, or anyone. So therefore, in the family, we must trust each other, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? Meaningful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Isam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government based in the capital Sana'a has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think that the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We could only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020, and as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. during the two-decade U.S. invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil.
The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak. mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protests through Brussels on Friday was organised by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least €20 billion for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the Eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The people providing the nation with care asking to be looked after by the authorities. Some of the tens of thousands of UK nurses who have walked off their jobs demanding better pay and conditions. Lakshmi has worked for the NHS for 22 years.
Shortages of nurses have led to less staff, and you can't care for people if you don't have a staff to care for. So it's person safety. Mainly, and if here comes, obviously people are leaving profession due to unfair pays, overworked, stressed, and shortage of staff.
Hailed as heroes during the pandemic, nurses up and down the country, Save Scotland, are staging two 12-hour strikes this week and next. Their representative body, the Royal College of Nursing, says they had no choice when the government rejected calls for talks on NHS pay. The RCN says nurses are 20% worse off in real terms today than they were in 2010 due to successive below-inflation pay rewards.
Things have gotten so bad that hospitals, one in four hospitals, are having to set up food banks for nurses and for other staff. This is unprecedented. But we're not just fighting for pay, we're fighting for the survival of the NHS.
One reason for that concern is the number of staff leaving the profession. 25,000 nursing staff have quit the NHS in the past year. The government says the demand for a 19% pay rise is not affordable. The unions argue the money is there. The nurses' strike is part of a wave of industrial action sweeping the UK this year, with the strikers demanding better pay and conditions as a worsening cost of living crisis pushes more and more people into dire straits.
The unions are warning that the strikes this month could be the beginning of a longer period of action if governments refuse formal pay negotiations or if future talks do not result in satisfactory outcomes. Saipur is up, London.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of iRabi English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
ایام فاطمیه عزای مادر سادات فاطمه زهرا سلام الله علیها.
During the commemoration days for the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, we must answer a serious question, and that is, can a person establish a revolution alone? This is because so many people believe that humans are not able to do important works alone. For instance, people believe that a person can't make changes in a society alone. However, the Holy Quran and Lady Fatima al-Zahra proved that revolution with the presence of one person is possible too.
قرآن کجا میگه یه نفر میشه؟ جایی که میفهمد قل انما اعظکم بواحده.
In the Holy Quran, Surah Sabah, Ayah 46, we read, "Say, I give you just a single advice, that you rise up for Allah's sake, in pairs or singly." This means that all our deeds must be for Allah. If we speak, write, or even are silent, it can be in a collective form or single. Therefore, rising up for Allah's sake, even if we are single, is possible, and Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra is a role model in this regard. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about our program on Call of Islam page, IRIB English Radio, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The night of Yalda, the longest night of the year. The night which falls between 21st and 22nd of December, known as the night of Yalda or the night of Chelle, in Iranian culture, and celebrated by Iranians for thousands of years, is the longest night of the year. Symbolically, the night of Yalda represents the birth of light and brightness. The festivity of Yalda in the Northern Hemisphere, the northern half of planet Earth, celebrates the longest night of the year, the end of autumn and the start of winter, and the fact that days become steadily longer after the passage of the night of Yalda. Traditionally, all members of an Iranian family, often an extended family, gather round on the night of Yalda, the night of 21st of December until the morning of 22nd of December, and spend the night in each other's company, reading poetry, such as Ferdowsi's Shahnameh or the Divan of Hafez, with elder members of the family telling stories and fables for the children and young ones, eating fruits and particularly pomegranates and watermelons, and also eating a variety of dried fruits and nuts. Stay with us as we tell you more about this wonderful, quintessentially Iranian festivity. Yalda is a word derived from the ancient Syrian language meaning birth. Shab-e Yalda, also known as Yalda Night, is celebrated on the last day of autumn, the 30th of Azar on the Iranian solar calendar. Symbolically, the night of Yalda represents the birth of light and brightness. Our forefathers celebrated the night of Yalda with the night of Chelle, reading poetry, literature and stories until the early hours of the morning and until daybreak. Clearly, the family unit and the extended family is very important to Iranians, and the Night of Yalda is a wonderful opportunity for all members of an extended family to gather.